Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released new statistics this spring on the prevalence of autism. The CDC now estimates that the developmental disorder, which causes difficulty with social interaction and communication, affects 1 in 59 children. This is an increase of 150% since 2000, when the CDC estimated the prevalence of autism at 1 in 150 children. The CDC creates this estimate with data from its Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, which looks at the rates of diagnosis among 8-year-olds at 11 sites across the country. To help us understand these statistics and the process of diagnosis, we've asked Rebecca Landa to join us. She's founder and director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders and the Research and Education for Autism in Children program at Kennedy Krieger Institute. She's also a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
How is autism diagnosed?
Well, there is a very thorough process. Ideally, you get a developmental history and a medical history on the child, and then you do behavioral observations that are very systematic and usually preferably with the gold standard called the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. And then there's sometimes cognitive testing, also language testing to make sure that this isn't a simple language delay. And so through this process of understanding the parent's perspective and your direct observations, you come to formulate a diagnostic impression.
So this can be done when a child is how old?
Really, we can diagnose autism accurately by 18 months.
Is it done that often? That early?
Not that often. Even though most parents are already concerned about their child by the third birthday, if that child ends up with autism, only about 42% of children with autism have had a comprehensive evaluation by that age.
That the process you just described to us takes about how long?
Well, it can take anywhere from, I think cumulatively, probably about 4 hours.
And is it tends to be done all at once?
Well, it depends on the age of the child. So as children get older, more testing is possible. The child has more abilities, and the competing diagnoses also become more numerous, and so there's more to investigate. So sometimes the evaluation process takes a bit longer if children are older.
Who should be making a diagnosis?
Most of the time, insurance companies will reimburse a physician or a psychologist to make a diagnosis.
Is a diagnosis by a pediatrician a good thing, or should it be more specialized?
Most pediatricians are not comfortable making a diagnostic decision about autism, only because there can be a lot of nuances to the disorder. And most pediatricians aren't trained in development and in developmental psychopathology. So they know what the red flags are, and they make referrals usually. I'm saying usually because some pediatricians do specialize in developmental disorders.
There have been headlines about technology like brain scans or eye movement tracking for diagnosing autism. Are those experimental methods?
They really are. They have not reached the point yet for clinical adoption.
Do you think we're heading toward some set of tests that would be quicker and more definitive?
I think that, you know, everyone's looking for biomarkers for autism, and it's turned out to not be so straightforward. Like, even if you went for an image, a brain scan, what you have to do is, you know, there's a lot to do to get the child to be successfully still in the scanner. And in addition to that, somebody has to measure the images from the brain scan or analyze them. So, you know, that all takes human effort as well. So I think for parents going through the diagnostic process with somebody face-to-face, understanding all the nuances of their child's behavior is a very appealing process for families.
These new numbers from the CDC, 1 in 59 children, do they indicate we're getting better at diagnosing, or do you think autism is being overdiagnosed?
I don't think that that number represents an overdiagnosis, because the process that's gone through with educational and medical records to identify the autism symptoms is so painstaking that even if a child had been diagnosed with ASD, autism spectrum disorder, if their records didn't indicate that, they wouldn't have been counted. So I think that number is probably pretty accurate, and I think we have gotten a lot better at recognizing the subtle signs of autism, so we can detect it even in people who don't have cognitive impairments.
Words like epidemic get thrown around in the news coverage of autism. What do you want people to know about these numbers?
I want people to know that autism is not a rare disorder, that pretty much everyone knows somebody with autism. And I think everyone needs to become curious about autism and learn what this looks like. I always say that if somebody's had a stroke, the world becomes accommodating and non-judgmental. Just, you know, how can I help you? And I think when we think about autism, this is something that the brain hasn't networked itself in the same way as people who don't have autism. And so information processing is different for them. And I would love for the world to know more about that, lend a hand, and open your sphere to include them as friends and colleagues.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Rebecca Landa, director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders at Kennedy Krieger Institute. We're talking about diagnosing autism, a developmental disorder that can impact social interaction and communication. I assume that, as with most disorders that affect development, early detection is better. The average age of a child who's diagnosed is what?
It's about 4.5.
And is that early enough to make a difference? Have you lost a chance to make a difference if you don't know until 4.5?
You haven't lost a chance to make a difference. So I want to encourage parents not to beat themselves up if they haven't had a diagnosis until later for their child with autism. But I will say that if children are detected early, we can get in there and start to really shape how that brain develops. And also, now we're very keen on helping parents acquire strategies for engaging their infants as a public health approach. We know so much now about how to stimulate rich brain development in infancy. And in fact, we're funded right now by the National Institutes of Health to do this with families whose children might have subtle indicators of social or communication delay, you know, all autism aside, where we're actually looking at what happens when we put these cool strategies in families' hands for playing with their children during late infancy.
Can you give me a brief idea of what one of these strategies
is? Yeah, very simple, actually. And that is to comment on what your infant is doing, to use toys that are very accessible for infants, to understand what babies do with objects. I mean, babies do things that parents maybe don't think is that useful for brain development, like banging and shaking objects or mouthing objects. And we help parents to know how to turn these into really productive engagement experiences.
If we're learning now that very many more children seem to have autism, presumably there then are older children and teenagers who were not diagnosed. I mean, what is the message there? What can be done?
So if you suspect that you may have autism symptoms yourself, or a loved one does, it's a good idea to go talk to someone about that, because the amount of relief that you get by having insights into the way that you react to things and to learn strategies for more adaptive reactions to things and to create a more smooth pathway for yourself in terms of your relationships with other people and even job options that might be a better fit for you can be life-altering.
What resources are available for families in Maryland who have young children with autism?
Really a lot. So we do have our public education system, but we also have Kennedy Krieger Institute, you know, which is a world-renowned center. And, you know, there are also other organizations, that support families like Pathfinders for Autism, the Autism Society of America, chapters are everywhere. There are great networks.
Other resources?
Yes, every jurisdiction in our state has an early intervention program. It's a publicly funded education program so that parents can go and have their child tested for free. And this is not specific to autism. It's for any developmental concern. And then they also, if your child qualifies, provide free intervention, even in your home or in your child's child care center.
Wow.
Yes. And all families have to do is to just get onto the Maryland State Department of Education, Early Childhood or Early Division of Special Education website to find out where these places are within their state. I'm sorry, within their county.
Kids, of course, grow up to be adults with autism. What resources do you think families and society need to be attuned to make that transition smoother?
Well, the biggest piece of advice I have regarding that is to start early. So even at 10, 11, 12 years of age, parents want to be thinking about transitions. What kind of transitions? I'm talking about transitions from the pediatric to the adult healthcare system, transitions from high school into employment situations, transitions in recreation and living situations. So there's a lot to do.
Do you think that as these numbers of these estimates of how many children are on the autism spectrum, as that number gets bigger, are there going to be more resources and more help with transitions?
I'm quite sure of it. There are advocacy groups and people like us who are working in the community with employers and working with high schools to make sure that high schools are providing students with the right tools and internship experiences. Universities like Towson University has a program for adults with autism. So more and more, there is becoming more and more options.
There's also an annual conference for families?
Every year, the Center for Autism at Kennedy Krieger Institute offers a conference on autism, and it's really ideal for professionals or family members or even self-advocates with autism because we deal with issues ranging from early childhood all the way into adulthood. It's a great resource.
When is it this year?
It is in mid-October.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Rebecca Landa is the founder and director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders and the Research and Education for Autism and Children program at Kennedy Krieger Institute. She's also a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Quick break here on The Record, and when we come back, adjusting to college life when you have autism. We'll learn more about a mentoring program at Towson University. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Each year, thousands of students on the autism spectrum graduate from high school. Heading off to college can present challenges, a new environment, roommates, internships. In addition, the supports mandated by law at public high schools fall away. How can colleges support students on the autism spectrum as they navigate this transition? At Towson University, students with autism can apply for the College Orientation and Life Activities Program, known as COLA. COLA helps students achieve their social and academic goals through mentoring, one-on-one meetings with staff, and group sessions with other COLA participants. COLA is facilitated by the Hussman Center for Adults with Autism, part of Towson's Institute for Well-Being. Kenny Bassford participates in the COLA program. He's a sophomore at Towson studying forensic chemistry. Thanks for being here.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Justin Brown, a senior at Towson University, studies business administration. He's a peer mentor in the COLA program. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Kenny, why did you decide to apply for the COLA program?
I would say the main reason why I decided to apply to COLA in the first place was due to the fact that my first year at Towson was kind of hectic. First time being there, didn't know anyone, and I heard about COLA, I guess, kind of through the grapevine. when I first got to COLA, I was very like, is this going to even work out? And things kind of went from there, and I would say it was a very nice fit. They paired me up with Justin, and we shared a lot of common interests. And from there, we pretty much like talked, and he would encourage me to try new things. And that's pretty much how it went.
So you usually meet twice a week,
right,
with Justin, and what happens? What kinds of things do you do?
It depends on the weather and our schedules, but there are times where we just study. Sometimes we go out hiking. Sometimes we go out to eat. It's kind of like a buddy system in a way.
Gotcha. Justin, how did you get involved with COLA as a mentor?
I actually started with COLA through the service class. It's like a volunteer service class. I began my volunteer study work at the Husband Center. And I enjoyed what I did there so much, I asked if there's absolutely anything I'd do to keep involved in the Husband Center, and then they pointed me in the direction of COLA.
You have been Kenny's mentor for 3 semesters.
Yeah.
How has your relationship changed over that time?
Definitely we've gotten a lot closer, and we're opening up to each other more. We're more willing to talk about things like grades, because when we first started, we were definitely feeling each other out. This is a new person, we don't know each other, we're going to be doing stuff, but as we began talking, like Kenny said, we did find interests. We found things that we could push each other on. Like, Kenny's actually one of the big reasons I get the grades I do, is because we do spend a lot of time at the library.
So you get better grades because of the time you spend studying with
Kenny.
Yeah,
it's definitely a mutual relationship. I feel that we both get stuff out of the program.
Kenny, help me understand better something specific that the COLA program has helped you do.
I would say one of my goals was like, oh, maybe you should learn how to, I guess, get more involved in conversations. Because normally I would just kind of be the equivalent of like a wall in a conversation where I would just be there and just smile and nod. But with Justin, we would sit there and like get more involved with more social situations. And I can see that it's been benefiting me a lot.
What do you think it's going to help with in the future?
I would say, like, mainly job interviews. That would be the main one that I can think of, at least.
Thank you both for talking to us about it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
Kenny Basford takes part in Towson University's College Orientation and Life Activities Program, COLA. Justin Brown is a peer mentor in COLA. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Joining us now is Zoja Zax, Manager of Programs and Education at the Husband Center. He supervises the service learning course that peer mentors are required to take. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How many students participate in the COLA program?
We have 7 students participating in the COLA program.
And do you expect the program to grow over time?
Yes.
Why?
That's what we hope. Well, students on the autism spectrum have incredible potential to succeed. And so we want to help make that happen by continuing to grow the program.
And your sense is that their students are hearing about it and wanting to take part?
Yes.
The service learning course you teach is not from a clinical point of view. It's from a cultural perspective. What does that mean?
Well, at Towson University, all students have to take a diversity class, and this is one of them. So we're looking at autism as a diversity in society, and traditionally people on the autism spectrum and people with other kinds of disabilities have not really been integrated into the community and haven't had the same opportunities as their peers. So we're looking at why and responding to that issue through kind of a social justice lens. And so they're coming to the Husband Center, my students, in the IDHP 300 class and participating in programs alongside the autistic adults. And the idea is they're not there to fix the autistic adults. They're there to learn from them and to solve some of these societal problems.
How long have you been teaching that course?
Since 2013.
Do you think it's catching on? I mean, is the message coming through?
I do, definitely. When I first started teaching the class in 2013, I would ask how many students in the class had heard of ableism, and almost nobody would have raised their hands. Now I can ask that question, and a lot of students are raising their hands and saying, yes, it's discrimination against people with disabilities. And I'll ask how many of you have heard of neurodiversity, and a lot of them have heard about it, whereas even 4 or 5 years ago, that wasn't the case. So I do think the message is getting out there.
Give me an example of how you've seen students with autism benefit from the COLA program.
I think that it reduces isolation, which is really important for success at college.
Give me an example.
If you're isolated and not connecting to other people and not enjoying all the activities at college and you're not feeling good about yourself, it's hard to stay motivated and get your work done and, you know, do all the requirements for your academic class. Also, I think when students are isolated, it's hard to do group projects. It's hard to, you know, group. There's a lot of aspects of the classroom that are very social that we don't necessarily think about.
Right, but I was just wondering if there was a particular student whom you saw make a change.
We had one student, for example, who was having some challenges living in the dorm with her roommates. This was before she got to COLA. And in truth, never was really able to identify exactly where the tension was or what was going on. But then once she was in the COLA program, her peer mentor was able to really help model for her how to be a roommate and how to succeed at, you know, living in the dorm with other girls her age. And she was able to do that much more successfully. And it does have an impact on the academics. Then you're more motivated and you're more apt to do well in the classroom.
Let's welcome Kathy Clark, director of the Hussman Center for Adults with Autism at Towson's Institute for Well-Being. The Hussman Center offers programming for adults with autism in the community, activities like fitness and cooking classes. Kathy, so COLA is for Towson students. The programs at the Hussman Center are for the community. Why are you trying to reach that audience?
There are a lot of adults in the community who graduate from high school and they don't have meaningful structure, meaningful activities in their life. So there's a need. And Towson University identified this need and recognized that we could not only provide a service to the community members with autism, but we could work with the course, provide service learning, increase that awareness of autism to the Towson University community, and that it would be a mutual relationship that would benefit the participants, the adults with autism, and the students at Towson University.
So give me an example of what participants have asked for that you've been able to create programming around.
So we are currently this summer running a rock climbing program, and this we had talked with some individuals just who are doing fitness. They're active in fitness, but they're looking for other ways to be active, not just coming to the gym, but what are some other ways. And so we collaborated with the gym at Towson University and are offering rock climbing this summer.
Another example?
Zosha, can you think of another example?
Sure. A lot of the autistic adults tell us that they have goals for themselves. They have social goals. They may want to make a friend. They may want to find a girlfriend. And I think that that's where we can come in and help them to gain some social skills, not in the sense of we're trying to make you normal, but to help you do the things that you want to do. And so that informs a lot of programs, including even rock climbing. You might not think that there's anything social to that, but it's all about taking turns, encouraging one another, getting along with your peers when there's a conflict. How do you solve it? You know, patience with people who are different than you. So I think they're getting a lot of rich social skills, but based on what they want to achieve, not based on what our idea of, you know, normalcy is or something like that.
Well, thanks for telling us about it. It sounds like great work. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for asking about it.
Kathy Clark directs the Hussman Center for Adults with Autism at Towson's Institute for Well-Being. Zosha Zaks manages programs and education at the Hussman Center. Earlier, we spoke with Kenny Basford and Justin Brown, students at Towson and partners in the College Orientation and Life Activities program there. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to information about COLA and the Hussman Center for Adults with Autism. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.